The UK Psych Health and Safety and ISO 45003 podcast. The goal of the UK Psych Health and Safety podcast is to be your source of information on psychological injury prevention, health promotion, and best practice. In doing this, we aim to rapidly advance the global practice of psychological health and safety in workplaces and adoption of best practices from the ISO 45003 standard. We will be looking at fully integrated approaches to managing psych health and safety and well-being strategy in the workplace that meet the needs of everyone in the organisation. Your regular host will be Peter Kelly, Senior Psychologist with the UK Health and Safety Executive, and Sheila Lord of BMR Health and Wellbeing. Every week, we will have a guest episode from the fields of health and safety, human resources, psychology, and academia who are leading the way in their corner of the globe.
Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of the UK Psych Health and Safety Podcast. I'm Sheila Lord, and I am joined today, as usual, by Peter Kelly, who's a little bit under the weather today. He's got a bit of a chest infection, a bit of man flu.
It's a lot of man flu.
So like I said, man flu. And also joining us today is our guest, Amy McCowan. Amy is an award-winning mental health and well-being strategist and is also an advocate for women's health. So welcome to the podcast, Amy. It's great to have you on the show.
Hi, both. Thank you.
Excellent. So, Amy, why don't we start with you telling us about how you came to work in the space of mental health and your kind of experiences so far to date?
Sure. So I think the honest answer to that would be accidentally. I sort of fell into the world where health and mental health meets workplace 20 years ago. Largely through my father. So I grew up in Cheshire, and my father is a clinical psychiatrist, and he specialised in stress, anxiety and depression in the 80s, which was when no one was really talking about these things. And he was a bit of an unusual fellow. So as well as having his private psychiatric clinical practice, we were up there, he was medical director of private psychiatric hospitals, but he also ended up both Bupa's psychiatric advisor, so writing all the clinical psychiatric pathways for Bupa. But when I was in my late teens, he was awarded an honorary degree in occupational medicine for putting in the mental health support at AstraZeneca. So kind of workplace evening chats at home were about how, you know, health, mental health, stress, anxiety, depression, the role of the workplace in that at AstraZeneca, and how we can look after people in the workplace. With Bupa, we were having discussions about, you know, clinical pathways in private health insurance and the role of private health insurance. So it really was accidental in that that was what, it was a family business. And in my early 20s, I went off to UCL and did a degree in human sciences, where I did a lot of clinical and occupational psychology, as well as business and IT and other clinical subjects. In those days, there was no such thing as sort of well-being or workplace health or mental health and stuff. So whenever I talked to people about wanting to combine healthcare with business, they were pushing me either towards insurance or to hospital management. So I, long story short, I ended up starting my own business. So my father had created a CD-ROM, which was high tech in those days, it was a very early version of Unmind or Headspace. But the idea was that when he was running workshops for senior managers at AstraZeneca, he felt that half a day workshop wasn't a lot. So he started to compile a CD-ROM of all of his knowledge and skills that was basically early cognitive computerized behavioral therapy to give out to people at these workshops. So age 21, I asked for the rights of the CD-ROM to see if I could turn it into a business, which was a great idea at completely the wrong time, in that Facebook didn't exist and neither did seed capital. But I spent my 20s running a mental health tech startup, trying to get this online tool into organizations to support their staff, you know, confidentially online, all of the things that like mental health tech is doing now. But in those days, and I got a lot of traction in police forces and universities and large public sector organizations. But in order to get this thing up and running, I ended up having to write their whole occupational health and mental health strategies. So I ended up with a sort of decades worth of accidental experience in all aspects of health and mental health within an organisation.
Fantastic. Excellent. That's really, really good background, Amy. So tell us about some of the more recent work that you're doing and talk to us about this creation of a workplace mental health strategy. Because what we see a lot of at the moment is very much reactive strategies that focus on things like mental health training, mental health awareness, EAP programs. And many organizations feel that they're doing the right thing. But what is that right thing to be doing if we want to do this well from end to end?
Okay, so there's a few questions there. What I'm doing at the moment is I'm an independent consultant helping organisations write strategies. So I'll come more onto that in a second. But I ended up in sort of 2008 at Ernst & Young, accidentally again, because I was trying to sell my business and the recession hit. And they approached me with, I've got a master's in digital health and health informatics. And I was able, when I was there, to take everything I'd learned and write a health and mental health strategy, which I then got seconded down to HR to implement. So I ended up with this experience of having taken a piece of paper that I'd written and then implementing it across 14,500 people. So that was, you know, what I guess I was really known for, you know, and as I did that, kind of mental health and wellbeing took off. So I now independently consult. So the last project that I did, which I finished last week, was I've just written the European Parliament's mental health strategy. So that was a fascinating piece of work that's taken me this autumn. But it was, the European Parliament has about 10,000 employees, and it was writing their mental health strategy. So I guess I'm kind of, the EY experience has led me to be, you know, known for big, large, complicated strategies. So the EP Parliament, obviously, it's a government. Prior to that, I did a FTSE 100's global strategy. So I work with big, sort of large organizations, but also I've got a client that's got 20 people, so tiny little ones. And what I'm increasingly doing is helping people write their strategies and doing niche projects. So I took a FTSE 100 through the procurement of a mental health app earlier this year. I'm increasingly helping people look at, you know, what health and mental health providers are out there and what to use. And in answer to your point, Sheila, like what's happened in the last 5 years is that health, mental health and wellbeing has exploded. It's everywhere and all organizations seem to be doing it. I think it's fair to say a lot of those organizations seem to be doing it really badly. So what I often see is a lovely person attached to HR who's got the wellbeing hat, who doesn't necessarily have any sort of health or mental health experience, and organizational strategies that are collections of tactics or activities cobbled together into something that looks like a strategy without really any structure. So the sorts of clients I have who approach me now tend to fall into three camps. They tend to be organization that wants to do something on health, mental health and well-being, and there's so many providers and so much to do out there that they're kind of like a bit like a rabbit in the headlights and don't know where to start. Or they're people like the European Parliament who've got a strategy in place that they've kind of put together and they've run it for a couple of years, but they've realized that they don't really know what they're doing and it's got them so far, but they want to kind of really figure out the next step of that. Or organizations who want a talk or a masterclass or a specific project, like a help with a procurement, like the mental health app. So that's what I'm kind of seeing out there. And what I, in answer to your question about what organizations are doing, you know, I'm trying to choose my words carefully because I have a reputation for being a bit blunt and that's never good. So lots of people are interested in mental health. It's very, you know, I woke up this morning to a article that my friend sent me, which was Prince Harry with his wealth of mental health experience telling people that they should quit their jobs if they are making them mentally unhealthy, which is, I think, a great position to be in if you've never had a job and you have your house paid for. But I digress. You know, everyone's talking about mental health. So lots of organizations are doing it. And lots of organizations are doing it with really good intent. They want to get this right. I think this next year, 2022, they have to get this right. You know, we're facing the Great Resignation. We're facing coming out of the pandemic. You know, health, mental health is a topic. The trouble is that there's not that many people with that many skills or experience in knowing what to do. And it's still very much the jobs that I see in health and wellbeing are still about 5 or 6 levels down from the board, sat in HR, quite junior roles, very little budget, very little actual power to do anything, and being filled by people who are enthusiastic amateurs. So people who care about wellbeing because they're into Pilates or mindfulness or stuff, but that's a very different skill set from writing an organizational strategy. And you know, your point about it being reactive is that we are, as a society, used to reactive healthcare. You know, my dad always used to talk about the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff as opposed to the fence at the top. We only go and see the doctor when we're ill. So kind of a lot of the things are reactive. And there's also been, since the 80s, when EAPs and private health insurance came into the UK market, they sold themselves as a, if you've got an EAP, you as an organization don't need to do anything. So there's still this mentality that having an EAP and a mental health first aider and someone in, you know, Headspace app is has solved mental health, which, as we know from the work that you do and Peter's been doing all this time, it actually doesn't. There's so many different aspects that need to be put into a strategy if the strategy is actually going to have an impact. Yeah.
I think it's interesting though, isn't it? I mean, I often use the illustration, we don't wait until you've lost your arm 3 times on a guarding on a machine before we put a guarding on the machine. And yet in mental health, we just wait till they're ill and then we assume we can treat them rather than, you know, doing something. In terms of strategy or strategic sort of oversight, do you think organizations becoming more aware of it because what COVID-19 has done is really emphasize the inadequacies of some systems that we've had, particularly when you've embedded wellbeing in HR and not in health and safety. There's a disconnect between people's experience, isn't there? So on the one level, we were sending people home to work in some cases, but we weren't actually looking at the systems and processes that facilitated their mental health, which is part of that process of, you know, isolation and loneliness.
Well, that's an interesting question. So I think there's more awareness of mental health, and I think that a lot of organizations realized last year that it needed to be sorted out with the pandemic. I still, you know, there are some organizations starting to do great stuff, so I don't want to sound all doom and gloom, but I still think my experience of the pandemic was a lot of people bought their employees an app and reminded them where the mental health first aiders was, which I actually, you know, I put a post out last year mid pandemic, which was, you know, mental health first aiders is someone who's been on a 2-day literacy training course, right, who's probably at home dealing with all of the same issues that all of us are doing in the pandemic. Is it safe to be actually referring people to that person, you know, when we don't know what's going on? But my experience of a lot of organizations during the pandemic was utter blind panic, reminding people of the mental health first aiders and the EAP, and then trying to get them, you know, I think it was a good time. And unlike when I was running my mental health tech startup, last year was a good time to be a mental health tech startup people because organizations were buying them because they were in panic mode, right? So I think that's where we are. I'm not sure yet how much of this, you know, I still think we're a decade behind COP in that people were talking about CSR for a long time. And it's only really in the last year that actually it's become a board level issue. I don't think health, mental health is a board level issue yet at a strategic level. I do think, and I've been saying this in the last few months, which has not gone down well, but I think who pays for healthcare is going to be the question for the next decade, right? So I think what, now that we're, you know, we're still in the pandemic, right? We're out of acute mode. We're kind of moving into the next phase, which in some ways is a more difficult phase because the impact of the first phase, people are dealing with the processing of trauma. People are kind of just coming out of panic mode. A lot of the workshops I've been running recently about how to design health and mental health strategies within organizations, it's been very clear that people coming to a design workshop have just needed space to share how awful the last 18 months was. So I'm actually putting a post out on LinkedIn this week about actually 2022, we need to be creating facilitated held spaces in organizations to process what's just happened. So we're not even remotely out of the mental health impact of the pandemic. But then we're going to have this awakening reality, which, to be blunt, we've never really faced as a society, which is who pays for health and mental health care? That's going to be the question of the next decade, because we've all grown up in this world where the NHS is free. And actually, if you're an organisation and Peter's off with a chest infection, we just wait for Peter to go and see the GP. And the GP will sort Peter out and then eventually he'll be back at work. Well, that contract is broken now because the NHS is more stuffed than it ever has been before. And actually, I'm increasingly having conversations with organisations about paying for virtual GP services, paying for occupational health, paying for good psych care, because, you know, if you get onto an NHS waiting list, it's going to take 18 months. And I had a conversation with an organisation a few weeks ago where I was suggesting that, you know, because the way I work is slightly different to the approach of the health and safety executive and the 45003. I'm less psychosocial risk assessment. I tend to start working with clients and I look at why they're doing a strategy, what they want to achieve, that sort of structure. And yes, sometimes psychosocial risk assessments slot into what they want to do. But it's really the first question I ask any client is, what are you doing and why? Because I think most of the strategies I see are like fluffy little mission statements about reducing the stigma and increasing the awareness, which is not, you know, that's not a what or a why. So I start with that. So I was having this conversation, and what sort of behaviours are you trying to drive, and what does good health look like to you? So I started talking about smoking, and I said, you know, are you going to put that good health to your organisation is that people don't smoke? And they balked, and they said, well, we're an employer; it's not our position to tell people not to smoke. And I said, well, no, but you could offer like something like the Alan Carr method, but actually, you're paying for private health insurance. And your premium is higher because you've got smokers in your staff. And that was this kind of real eyes off moment, which was like, oh God, yeah, she's right. Because none of us really have asked ourselves difficult questions in the last 5 decades since the NHS is there, in that who's paying for our healthcare? Who's responsible for our healthcare? And I think increasingly the next decade will be a conversation about, is the individual, you know, if someone's chosen not to get vaccinated, they've got equal access to the NHS as someone who has at the moment. You know, if you've chosen to smoke, you know, the NHS sorts you out, right? That, what's your individual responsibility? What is an organization's responsibility in that buying a GP service or good psych support or commissioning secondary care might mean that your employee, like Peter's, back at work quicker? And thirdly, what's the role of society? So I think the next question for the next decade is going to be who pays for this stuff. And invariably, that will mean conversations about health and mental health will move away from a mental health first aider to actually proper care. And that's, I think, where we'll go. But I don't think anyone wants to admit, either they haven't clocked onto that or they don't want to admit it yet, because it's really nice to have this kind of like, we just pay through our tax for all of this stuff and it happens, but it doesn't. And, you know, at Ernst & Young, I did a calculated, because a lot of organisations have private health insurance that's an employee benefit through grade. So I looked at two people who were off, both at a junior grade and at a senior grade, who were off with the same thing. So obviously the junior grade had no health insurance and the one who was senior did. And I quantified it. You know, the person who didn't have health insurance was off sick for longer because they couldn't get access to care. So my suggestion was that rather than looking at health, like private health insurance, as a nice thing that you have when you're senior, actually it was regarded as a business tool from the board to actually get people back in the workplace well and doing their jobs properly, which I know is a cold, hard way of looking at healthcare, but actually it's better than pretending, which we all are now, that, you know, healthcare is free and that no one should pay for it. And that actually it's not your individual responsibility or your responsibility as an employer to look after people.
The problem is that healthcare is always set at the individual, though, isn't it, Amy? It's never set at seeing it as an overriding, you know, key driver for the organisation, that we need to look at organisational health in terms of, you know, addressing it through prevention rather than cure. You know, the principles of the Health and Safety at Workers Act is the prevention of ill health. It's not the it's not the treatment of ill health, you know, in the context of work. So,
but I think it comes down to who pays for it. Again, I think it will change, because you're only interested in preventing something that you've then got to pay for the cost of, right?
Yeah. The cost is more if you pay for something that is ill. Then is it cheaper to do it before? Well, of course it. Yes, it is.
Yeah.
But there's no obvious win.
No, but I think that will have to shift, because I think, you know, what you're seeing now is that NHS waiting lists are higher than they've ever been. So actually, for an organisation to front healthcare and pay for someone to go through their systems much quicker, means that you then start an interesting conversation about prevention. Because if you're paying for healthcare, then you've obviously got more of an invested interest in prevention. And I can't see a way of the NHS getting out of the very acute problems it has. You know, if I was Boris, I'd be looking at things like giving tax breaks to large organisations that are paying for primary or secondary care. You know, I think we might end up in a world where, you know, large organisations are commissioning healthcare. I mean, it's a long way off, but I think actually the pandemic is really going to change the conversations we're having about who pays for health and mental health. And that will therefore change the conversations about what prevention means. Because if you're paying for someone's healthcare, you've got far more incentive, especially with something like mental health, which can be uncapped, to actually make sure that the risk factors, the sort of stuff you've been doing for years, Peter, kind of are correct, you know, so that people aren't getting that ill and therefore don't cost as much.
And I think, again, organisations are actually paying for a lot of this illness at the moment. They just don't see it in the way things are presented to them. And that's it. You had to go and quantify that.
Yeah.
Example to demonstrate.
Well, we don't. If you actually think, I mean, I do this exercise with a lot of organisations, which is I start to look at the cost of absence to them. So if with professional services, it's not just paying Peter to be at home, it's also the lost revenue of him doing client work. You know, if you do that across the organisation, because at the moment we only really think about the impact of Peter's absence on his team, we're not quantifying it. And then you look at the cost of retention. And what I mean by retention is, how much, right? And most organizations haven't done this. If someone leaves an organization because they've got a health problem that's spiraled out of control, how much it costs. And when I say how to replace them, when I say how much it costs, I mean most companies just look at how much it costs to go to a recruitment agency. But no, how much it costs for your in-house recruitment people. You're going to have to interview 10 people, you know, the cost of partner or senior people's time to interview them, the cost of inductions, how much it costs. And even for like a PA, you're looking at tens of thousands of pounds to replace someone. So once you start having conversations about absence cost and retention, and then most organizations now are buying, you know, large ones especially, but even smaller ones, are already paying for healthcare. They're buying things which are, you know, EAPs, perk box, private health insurance, occupational health, an app, you know, mental health first aiders. Once you start adding this up, it's a bit of a jaw drop moment for most organizations, because they've gone, oh, and this is the conversation I try and steer it to. I don't try to steer it to, you need to start paying more for health. What I do is I say, this is how much you're already spending on health, which is being spent in a completely unstructured, unstrategic, unthought through way. If we change this spend and topped it up but bought X, then actually you'd save on those, and it would either be net kind of zero, or it would be, you know, actually it would cost more, but actually be so much more effective as an organization. Those are board level conversations that we should be having around health and mental health. They're much more difficult though than, do you want to just buy my app, or do you want to just run a workshop, and this workshop will do all of these things that we can never actually quantify.
You're absolutely right, Amy. It's about redistributing that, but it's what, how do we get from, you know, what you said earlier, where you've got the enthusiastic amateurs with no budget, 5 or 6 steps removed from the board, to get the board seeing these numbers and understanding these numbers and looking at well-being and mental health as the strategic piece that it is in terms of driving productivity and even profitability.
Listen, if I knew that, I wouldn't have spent 20 years where I am now. You know what I mean? I mean, what I can say, the positive, is that when I was in my mid-20s trying to sell an online mental health tool, I got laughed out of most boardrooms, right? So there's not a city firm that I didn't really target or get laughed out of. And I'd have these very awkward conversations as a young girl in my mid-20s where I was in a boardroom talking about mental health. I mean, you know, and I'd get hastily shown the exit. And usually the person who'd been most obnoxious, right, during the meeting would be the one who offered to show me out. And as he sort of walked, well, he or she, but generally he, walked me towards the door, they'd say, I really admire what you're doing. You know, my wife has depression, or my wife's an alcoholic, or my daughter self-harms, or I have depression. But their behavior in the boardroom would have prevented any of the stuff I've talked about ever happening. So we've moved away from that. So now all of these city firms are busy talking about health and mental health, right? But we're still at the stage now where if you get a senior leader to stand up once a year and talk about his lived experience, then tick, we've ticked that box. But I mean, I did that as 20 years progression. So like, you know, I think what will the next phase, because and one of the reasons I do so much content on LinkedIn is I think that genuinely people want to do this well. You know, they want to do it. No one goes into something to do it badly, I don't think. You know, that's not really, people will always take the easy option. But a lot of the time in health and mental health and wellbeing is not knowing what you don't know. You know, like if you go to see a doctor, you listen to what the doctor says to you because you're going to see an expert and he speaks a whole or she speaks a whole different language of clinical terms. I think with a lot of people around health and mental health and organizations, if they've got a provider that comes and talks to them with a load of clinical terms, they just panic. So instead of challenging a provider about what they're offering and how that's going to have an impact and stuff like that, they just freeze because we're used to medical discussions being from a position of imbalance. So I think where we are as a market in this stuff is that people don't know, you know, like they thought that mental health first aid and an app and an EAP would tick the box. You know, the next stage is understanding that it's not really going to get very far, and it's a really slow progression. But I do hold out hope that, you know, the next phase from the market on is actually, and I think COVID will have helped this in that I think a lot of boardrooms over the next year or two, we'll start to be having conversations about health and mental health because, like I said, I think we're only just at stage one of the pandemic.
Yeah, I remember years ago, I used to work in supply chain, and for years, we were always seen as an admin function that added no value to the business. And now you look at organisations 30 years later, and they recognise that supply chain is a massive contributor to bottom line. And for me, I'm thinking, you know, again, it's going to be that period of time, but, you know, well-being and looking after people eventually.
And the big four where I worked, you know, one of their biggest selling products for better or worse, right, was called Tesco, Tax Efficient Supply Chain Management, which is how you basically squirrel away profits in low tax organizations, low tax distinctions. Through your supply chain, right? So like all of them want to talk about building a better working world or whatever their slogans are now, but it was basically helping organizations through their supply chain to not pay taxes in organ. I mean, we're starting to see the world clamp down on it, as well it should, but you know, that was all done through the supply chain.
So I wonder what's going to go through on wellbeing then.
I think it's a reflection on, if you look at the global data that's coming through at the moment, there is a rise in depression and anxiety. We're not seeing rises in psychosis in the same level as we are in neurotic disorders such as depression and anxiety. And that's directly where work is impacted. Depression, anxiety, or PTSD, you know, the fact that the NHS has biblical numbers of sickness absence with people off with depression and anxiety. Yeah, it can be largely contributed to systematic failures in managing staff during the pandemic.
I agree. And I also think another big driver for change, as Peter said, is not just the numbers, but also young people. So, you know, when I was at EY, it was the graduates who were all over the health and mental health program to such an extent that we actually put in some specific graduate stuff for them. They were way more interested talking about stress, anxiety, depression, talking about alcohol, talking about self-harm, and they are the ones. I mean, what we've seen in the last 18 months, for better or for worse, I personally think if we get this right, it'll be for better, is people are leaving organizations where they don't feel they've been looked after properly. So you've already had a younger generation that were like, organizations need to do this stuff. Right, and they need to do it well. I'm only going to work for an organization that I know looks after me. But you're now seeing that kind of the pandemic has meant a lot of all people are like, well, I mean, even Prince Harry today telling people to leave jobs if they weren't being looked after. You know, I think that trend is going to increase. And I think it'll be a situation where if you've got an industry and you've got organizations that do it right, and you know, why I love what I do and have always loved what I've done is that health, mental health, it's so easy to get staff engaged. It's so easy to get people interested. It's so easy, you know, it's such a lovely thing to work in because people care about this stuff. You know, if an organization looks after the health and mental health of an employee and their family, they're just going to get so much productivity and engagement and loyalty from that people than if we treat them badly, which is why it's always been gobsmacking to me that organizations do this so badly. And especially, you know, I'm sat at you from my kitchen. You can see out of the house. You know, what the pandemic has done has potentially equaled the playing field for people like myself who've got young children to get into the workplace, stay in the workplace with senior jobs, people with mental health conditions, people with physical disabilities, people who couldn't get into the workplace before when it was going to an office 9 to 5 or 9 to 8, whatever it was, now have an opportunity. So this is like really exciting. And health and mental health has a big part to play in this because it's totally obvious, right, that actually if you're unwell, you're not going to be productive. And actually, if you look after people, they'll stay with you and be loyal and be better employees and more productive and your organization will do better. So, you know, we're moving into that light bulb, I think.
Mm. And it's odd, isn't it? We have to have a light bulb moment about being human. So we tend to switch that off when we...
Well, I think a lot of the challenges as well, and this is where I get into my women's aspect here, you know, a lot of the people making these decisions, you know, we created workplaces that worked very well a generation ago when you had one partner who was at home doing all the children's stuff and the other partner was at work. The real challenge now is that you need two salaries in order to have the same lifestyle as that. But we haven't evolved our workplaces. I mean, you can see what's going on in Parliament with Stella Creasy. You know, she has to go in to vote in the chamber and then, you know, she's not allowed to take her baby. And I have just been so interested in the comments. A lot of them were for women about how it's awful and she could afford childcare and all this sort of stuff. And you think, well, these are the sorts of conversations we should be having. Like this. You know, we spend 8 hours a day of our lives at work, right? And actually we've created organizational structures that really only work for people who are in really good physical and mental health and have no family or caring responsibilities and don't have kids that need picking up at 3:30. I mean, it's completely illogical. You know, these are the sorts of conversations we should be having because, you know, it can't continue. And as you said, Peter, rates of depression and anxiety, they're going up. Not just because of the pandemic, but because we've created this completely unsustainable working world that doesn't work for any family. I mean, my family life is cobbled together with like school runs of, you know, people help picking up one child here and helping me here and helping me there just so that you can work, all at vast expense. I mean, it just doesn't work. And I think the younger generation are just going to, I mean, you're seeing it check out. You know, why would we do that? Why would we stay in an organization for years? You know, which doesn't really look after me and doesn't work for my family when I could be a digital nomad in the Bahamas, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's become very evident in the financial services sector where they've had to adapt because actually there's a, you know, the top kids, young people that are coming in are advocating, look after my health.
Yeah.
And they're not even saying, but they obviously want a Ferrari. Everyone wants a Ferrari, don't they? But they want a Ferrari and their health. They don't want to sacrifice their health, their mental and physical health, for the great salary and everything else. I guess it remains to be seen that the people that are at the top of these organizations need to realize that there's a different way of working now. There's a different way of managing people rather than just burning them out. So
I think they have to. I mean, I was having an interesting conversation with my partner who works in an accountancy firm, a big, it's not in a big four, but the next sort of next size down. And what was fascinating was people used to go to these firms to do their accountancy qualifications. And then, you know, there was always a sort of a big brain drain after people have got their qualifications. But what's happening now is they're not even staying long enough to qualify. So it's really interesting because it used to be you'd go, you do your qualification, and then you could go off and, you know, either stay or work here or move jobs. Can't even get people to stay 2 years. Other SMEs as well can't get people to stay 2 years. People don't have the same, you know, I'll never forget, my first contract, I was working, it was a big systems integrator, and I signed a contract for them. And my dad looked at this contract and was like, I have never seen a contract like that. This contract that I'd signed with this organization didn't say where I'd be based or what job I'd be doing. You know, that was the contract. You know, that was what these consultancies and these big firms sign. And my dad was like, this is a generation I'm from. You used to go and you'd work at this location doing this role. A lot of these organizations have been successful in getting young people to sign contracts, which are, you can work anywhere for us at any time doing any job. And I think employees have had enough. I think actually the employers had all the power, and now we're getting to a position where employees are a bit like, well, actually, I don't want to work like that. I don't want to spend. I mean, I spent months living out of suitcases in hotels for these sorts of firms. You know, I was based up in Leeds for 6 months, based up in Liverpool for 6 months, which meant getting a train at 6 a.m. on a Monday morning, and I'd get home on Friday night. And the rest of the time I'd be working, you know, and living out of the hotel. People don't want to do that now. Or if they do, they want to do it for a short amount of time, but with some, you know, real, I think the balance is changing. People are like, well, that wasn't functional, didn't work, you know, didn't have any friends, can't go to the theatre, can't do this, can't go to my yoga class, right? Well, I'd prefer to earn less or do something else than do it. So it's fascinating. I think the next 2 years is going to be fascinating. But how we then start to talk about health and mental health in an organisation is fascinating as well, because I can't see how that can't be a discussion. You know, it's already creeping into CSR. So a lot of the conversations about CSR, you know, health is taking part of the S. But to me, it's I guess because of my family background, you know, if you are unwell physically or mentally, you are unable to really exist in society or work or do all these sorts of things. You know, I've always been quite a student. And if you think about environment stuff, you know, we're talking about having a healthy planet, right? You need healthy people on a healthy planet in order for society to function. So it's always been like, why is health and mental health not talked about more? Because it's like the first part of any functioning kind of, you know, human, you know?
Well, it's not talked about because we over the many years, I think we've effectively broken down the stigma which is attached. It's bloody stupid that you can get stigmatized for a common health condition. You don't get stigmatized for having a chest infection. You don't get stigmatized for having COVID, but you do get stigmatized for suffering from a mental health issue that impacts one in four. And, you know, we are realistically looking at one in three at this rate. And that is the same as cancer.
I'd say in a pandemic, it's one in one, Peter, you know.
Yeah. But let's remember that. That's the same as what, one in three people will be touched by cancer. And we throw a massive resource at the prevention of cancers. And we find ourselves with mental ill health, and we don't do the, we go, it's okay, let them get ill,
let's challenge you on the how we prevent cancers, because if you think about cancer, you know, we do still sell absolutely awful food that we know is making people sick. We do still, when we tax people, but we do still let people smoke. We do put more education campaigns, but, you know, it's still, the risk factors are still there. I mean, the risk factors are societal a lot of the time, and with mental health, the risk factors are societal, and this world we've built for ourselves as well. I mean, you know, with the women's health, mental health stuff, women have more incidences of depression and anxiety. And actually the data coming out of the pandemic showed that women were more likely to report depression, anxiety, or loneliness than men. And I think a lot of that, I mean, yes, obviously there's the hormonal aspect, there's the genetic aspect, there's the biological. I think a lot of the women's stuff comes from the role of women in society and the fact that, you know, women are doing most of the unpaid care work as well as trying to work, as well as this, you know. So I think a lot of the aspects of mental health I mean, there's the stuff you guys do, which is excellent in organisations, but I think a lot of the, some of the women's stuff is due to societal roles and societal structures and the way that we live. And those are much harder things to change. I mean, I think, again, Gen Z are starting to question some basic assumptions that the rest of us grew up with. But yeah, it's like until we start being really honest about massive structural changes, both in society and within organisations, then... And you know, everyone's raving about the pandemic as changing that. But I think it has really, you know, it led to some very interesting conversations in my household right at the start of the pandemic, where Matt was at home and he was like, oh God, I get like nothing done with the kids here. And I was like, oh, funny that. That's been my reality for 5 years. And you know, when you used to come home at 7 o'clock at night and ask what dinner was, and I would tell you to, you know, go to wherever, you know, and you would then have an argument with me that in fact 7 o'clock was really early to be home because people in your office weren't home at 7 o'clock, and that I was really an unfair person because I was putting pressure on you. Well, this is because my day has looked like this from 2:30 until 7. So you walk through the door at 7 o'clock, but I've given up my day at 2:30 to pick up 2 children, feed them, do their homework, wash them, clean up, put them in the bath. And then you walk through the door at 7 o'clock and tell me that you're home early, right? That doesn't work. So that, it was like this light bulb moment. And I hate to say, you know, like Matt now does pick up half of the days a week. You know what I mean? It's like, there's been a whole shifting of how our family works, because it was like, it was this light bulb moment. And it was interesting because he works in internal audit. And for years, women had been saying, well, can we not just do audit committees online? And it was like, no, it's impossible to do it online. We all have to traipse up to Leeds to sit in this room together to do an audit committee. Pandemic hit. Guess what? Audit committees are now all online. It's like, actually, it took us that for people to be like, oh, okay, yeah, these changes that only the women or the people with caring responsibilities have been asking for ages, actually, they suit us all now. And you know what? They work, right? Sheila, you're laughing.
I'm laughing because that's, you know, you're describing my life. And, you know, everything that you've said from, you know, the pandemic with people wanting different things now, the great resignation, you know, I used to go to work and I would do a 150-mile round trip in the car. I would leave on Sunday, stay in a hotel, come back on Tuesday evening, and I would see my son 2 hours within 3 days. And you just get to that point where I can't take this anymore. This is just not what I signed up for.
Also, we talk about depression and anxiety as if it's something that happens in the workplace. Yet all of the evidence shows that how you're parented and the amount of time you spend with your parents and your early years, you know, actually impacts your incidences of mental health going forward. So again, you know, you seeing your son 2-3 days hours in 3 days, you know, a lot of the mental health epidemic that we talk about, I'm sure, is to do with how we've been forced, and it is, you know, forced as opposed to choice, you know, to parent, you know, kids. Yeah, you know, a lot of the kids at my daughter's school get picked up by nannies because you don't see your parents because your parents are working till 6 o'clock, you know, schools finish at 3, like, and then we're now wondering why everyone's got problems, you know.
Absolutely. And now we've, in our family, you know, I gave up my job and now my husband's work has become more similar to what mine was. So now we've just swapped mums at home, but dad's away. So, and as you say, you need those, you know, there's always one or two of you that, you know, in order to have a certain level of lifestyle, you've got to sacrifice. And what you're sacrificing is your mental health and your family.
Yeah. And this is where the women's health, mental health stuff comes off, because what happens and what happened in my situation is the wheels came off my career in between the kids. And if you look, I mean, it's something like 54,000 women a year in the UK get made redundant in and around pregnancy and within the first year of birth. So that's 54,000 women. And certainly in my circle of friends, every single woman I know, I think bar one, got made redundant in or around pregnancy. Right, so you're talking about highly intelligent, productive, educated women who are forced out of the workplace. Some of them got made redundant once or twice, you know, more than once. Some of them have gone back to work. Others have given up. Others have done, you know, small kind of, you know, jobs kind of. So that, and then we talk about the UK having a GDP problem, right, in productivity. Well, you know, you've got highly intelligent, trained women sat at home because they can't get back into the workplace because it doesn't fit. But then we also talk about the levels of depression and anxiety. And I can tell you, you know, there's nothing more depressing if you're an intelligent woman that kind of like wanted a career to suddenly not be working or able to work just purely for repopulating the planet, right? You know, you know, it's kind of like the whole thing just doesn't really work, does it, you know?
Doesn't make sense, does it?
And then it's like, okay, well, we're all depressed and anxious and it affects one in four people. Well, yeah, of course it affects one in four people. Because yes, of course, mental health, there is a biological component, there is a hormonal component, there is a genetic component, there are all of these things. But a lot of the mental health conditions, I think, have a huge societal factor as well. And we've just built a non-functioning society. Kids don't see their parents. People can't really afford to keep a roof over their house without two people working. And, you know, schools that finish at 3:30, it's just the whole thing makes no sense, you know?
No, absolutely. So just bringing the conversation back, because I could talk about this for forever. You really got, you could get me right on my soapbox. But I just want to bring it back to, like, they're looking at the workplace health strategy and the emergence earlier this year of 45,003. Because again, in the past, as you said, you know, people have been enthusiastic, they've wanted to do this, they've not really known where to start. But now, what are your thoughts with now having ISO for managing mental health risk in the workplace available now, kind of coming out of this pandemic, as a framework for organisations that didn't previously know
what to do? Yeah, so I think it's a really good thing. And one of the things I was very pleased to see about the ISO standards is that the sort of sterling work that the Health and Safety Executive and Peter's been doing for decades now was a really good structure and framework, you know, around managing stress. And so the fact that there's now the ISO, and this is an international standard that psychosocial, it just validates that this is something that's really important and that employers should do, and that there's a framework behind it. I often get, so a lot of the rabbit in headlight type conversations I have with organisations is they don't know where to start. So it's a really good place for those sorts of organisations to start. I don't tend to, so I do work with it, but not, you know, you're the expert, and I tend to work, you know, with people like yourselves who are experts in that and write the strategic stuff around it. My approach is more like, what are you trying to achieve and how, and helping to put the structure in place. And ISO can really fit into that, because it's like, this is a structure and a methodology that you can then figure out what your risks are, and then we can build a strategy around it. I'm much better, and my expertise is in the what you do, how you address the issues and build a strategy and then implement. That's what my niche is. And that definitely gives a framework to that. You know, there have been other frameworks around, you know, mine's got its approach, business in the community. But what I like about this is it's something, and it's also something that health and safety professionals would understand, because they understand that background. What I've done in my latest organization is I've built them a health and mental health program, which is what they wanted, which is about making sure there's care pathways, L&D. It's like my structured framework for a program. They also have psychosocial risk assessments that they want to invest in more. And the two are kind of like circles with a Venn diagram that overlap in the middle. So I don't think it's an either or. I think you can do both, right? You can definitely do the ISO 450, the ISO thing, and you should do. And what that will give you is the bit where the two circles approach is you need a program, such as the sort of things I put in, to be able to impact on the things that your ISO risk assessment is bringing up, right? Because an ISO, I think a lot of organizations have in the past, my experience, been reluctant to go down the risk assessment approach as a first move, because if we discover we've got a lot of problems, we've then got to deal with them. So what I often suggest to organizations when I'm doing my sort of piece around developing a program for them is that they look at doing a risk assessment as well, but that they've got the framework of a program in place to be able to address some of the risks that it brings up. And that actually, if they really want to get prevention right, they should be doing an ISO or a kind of risk assessment. Yes, so that we've got the levers in place and the program and the infrastructure to address it. But you then design your prevention. When I design prevention, I tend to ask if there's a risk assessment and what if it's bringing up. But also the other thing I do, because obviously my background is numbers and health informatics, I spend a lot of time getting data from organizational data, but also if they've got things like private health insurance or an occupational health provider or an EAP, I get them involved and I look at who's using those programs for what illnesses we're seeing, who's using them, and then I design my prevention stuff based on the issues that an organization have and the illnesses we see. So for me, where iSafe fits really nicely is I have always tried to have a data underneath, so that firstly you're designing prevention based on what the things the organization needs are, and that's very different. You know, some of my clients are retail, so it's a very female workforce, right? Some of my clients are manufacturing, again, very different. You know, like I just said, the European Parliament, totally different again, and their issues are things like multiculturalism and the fact they're an expat community. So actually starting with what illnesses people have, what they're using, what services they're having, and designing your prevention based on something so you can then see the impact, and then it becomes iterative, is really how I tend to work. And I say it's fantastic for that, because you get some data, you can see what needs fixing, you can see the impact on it. I think, like I said, to repeat, most organizations were a bit reluctant to do risk assessment on their own, but I think there's a really nice Venn diagram where actually you can use a program, sort of the stuff I do, to have the levers to do it, and the two work really well together.
Absolutely. So I just want to, we've been chatting for a while now, so probably bring our chat to a close, because I think between the three of us we could talk till the cows come home, really. But what would be your advice, you know, that kind of one nugget of advice you'd give to business leaders, Amy, that they need to kind of really take on board moving forward?
So I would tell them that health and mental health is already costing their organization tens of thousands, if not millions, right? So it's already a cost, right? So this isn't a nice fluffy add-on that's going to make people feel better, right? We need to move out of the industrial ages of, you know, in the industrial revolution, we thought of people as resources and units that fulfilled functions in organizations. You know, in the 21st century, organizations are people doing jobs. And actually, it's the intelligence and the health and the mental health of these people that's actually making your organization function. So firstly, you're already spending a shed load of money on this stuff. And secondly, actually having a healthy, mentally healthy, functioning workforce is what you're going to need for your organization to be able to exist and perform properly. So, you know, it's not a sideline nice to have to just deal it for HR. This is a business issue, you know. And you're going to end up paying more for health. You know, why not be one of the first and do it properly and get the cream of the crop in terms of employees that want to work for you? Because everyone's going to end up doing this. Why not be the pioneer?
Fantastic. I think that's absolutely marvellous advice, Amy. So I just want to say thank you for your time today. It's been really insightful and love chatting to you as always.
Thank you to you both.
Amy, we could chew the yarn for hours, and I'm sure we will when we're next in Manchester. But always a radical voice in this space. And so always enjoy having a chat with you.
Well, thank you, Peter. Likewise.
You've been listening to the UK Psych Health and Safety Podcast. To stay up to date with the latest on psychological injury prevention and the new ISO 45003 standard, follow subscribe to the UK Psych Health and Safety Podcast at www.ukpsychhealthandsafety.com.